And then there was one time I was on the cruise ship, and we were out, I think we were in Greece. I want to say we were in, where was it? Rhodes, I think.
Yeah.
And I was on the beach with friends, and we're keeping track of the time. Like, we're doing well in time. And all of a sudden, I hear the horn, and I see the ship moving. Like, moving fast. I thought we missed the ship. Turned out it was in tender, and we just had to go take the tender to get to the ship. But we panicked and ran, thinking the ship was leaving without us.
No.
That was a horrible feeling. Oh, that was a horrible, horrible feeling.
Disaster, yeah. Oh, dear.
And the same ship, I remember there was one night, it was a horrible rocky night. We hit some sort of cyclone storm. And there's a part in the show where I vanish on the stage and I reappear in the audience.
Yeah.
Obviously, I've got to find a way to get there.
Yeah.
The only way to get there to that spot is to go outside the ship, come back in, go down the steps, step over all the darn strollers that are at the front, and run down to the center of the audience,
yes.
Right? So that night, we hit a cyclone storm. I do a costume change on my way out the doors. It was so bad, the huge door swung open. I ran and was holding the rails of the side of the ship to get to the side, and my wig blew off. So I appeared in the audience like a drowned rat with no hair, just sort of like, I pulled my normal hair down. Because there was no way I was going to get that other piece back on.
Oh,
and I literally, and I knew most of the people wouldn't be able to understand me. And all I said was, it's raining outside. And I just waited for their reaction.
I fell into a swimming pool once before a show.
Did you really?
And did the whole show in a soaking wet costume.
Oh, that's priceless, though.
Oh,
they're
God.
Like, maybe this is part of his thing.
Yeah, right. The
oh, that's
magician.
Too funny.
Hello and welcome. It is I, Big Ben, and this is season 4 of Meet the Entertainers. So far, I've interviewed 13 jugglers, or people who include juggling in their act. Likewise, I've interviewed 7 balloonists, 2 belly dancers, 1 face painter, 3 mentalists, 7 clowns, 2 living statues, 33 all-round variety entertainers, 8 stand-up comedians, 1 dancer, 3 unicyclists, 14 magicians, or people who include magic in their act, 8 birthday party specialists, 2 talent managers, and 1 Santa. So, please go to my website, www.thebigbenshow.com/podcast, to check out all the episodes, or subscribe on iTunes, or wherever you get your podcasts. And this is a special announcement. Well, maybe. I love interviewing entertainers, and I'm always looking for more people to interview. So please drop me a line, contact me right now at ben@thebigbenshow.com. I'd love to hear from you, and I'd love to find someone else to interview. And I won't say this every week, but just in case there's new listeners coming in for season 4, new listeners, well, let's say that again, embrace the homemade! That's right, I'm just sitting here in my room talking to my phone. Now, that wasn't the announcement for the new listeners. What I want to say to new listeners, if there's something in this podcast that you don't understand, just go to my website, thebigbenshow.com/podcasts, and there are videos and photos and detailed names and show notes to accompany this podcast, so you can probably find the information that you need, or just, again, email me. Right, so back to business. This week I'm talking to Jessica Jane Peterson, and there's loads of great stuff about magic, about circus sideshows, cruise ships, putting on your own show, and the business of show business. My thanks to Jessica for contacting me. I really, really enjoyed the interview. In fact, we talked for so long, this will probably be a two-parter. So, here we are, part one. Take it away. And where do we find you online?
We find me at two websites. I've got www.jessicajane.com. That's J-E-S-S-I-C-A-J-A-N-E.
Yeah.
And then I also have a show site at magicgatlinburg.com. And that's the show I do here in Gatlinburg, Tennessee.
Yeah. And are you doing a solo show next? Is that
I am. I'm so excited. It opens next Saturday.
Oh, my goodness. And that's...
I know. That's what I'm saying.
Wow. And how long is your solo show?
It's going to be an hour and 10 minutes, but I'm saying between an hour and a 10 and an hour and a half because I have too much fun with the audience members, and I know I'm going to accidentally add about 20 minutes to it because I'm going to have too much fun and I won't be able to stop myself.
Wow. And how do you go about directing a show like that? Do you have a director, or do you direct it yourself? Are you in charge of everything?
Well, it's one of those things where I've been in magic since I was a kid. And I've been around a lot of fabulous magicians, but I've also been around a lot of fabulous entertainers that have sort of influenced the way I think. One of the most brilliant directors I've worked with is the late Joni Spina, who was David Copperfield's choreographer for years.
Yes.
And she helped me a lot with, at different points in my career, too. I mean, even as a kid, I took her movement workshops, and I ended up working on a show on a cruise ship that was run by a fabulous studio magician by the name of Connie Boyd. And Joni gave guidance on that show. So... Joni really got in my head as far as being able to give me the ability to evaluate myself as a performer. So I'm very lucky that I can sort of walk out of myself and look at something and go, okay, this is good, but that's bad, and that needs to change, and this is awkward, but that's okay, and this is a different moment. And then I also have friends in entertainment that I trust, you know, that aren't just magicians, you know, that are dancers, that are jugglers, that are comedians, and I try to go to them and ask for their feedback because I figure everyone in different professions sees things differently, and I want opinions from everyone. Like, I would rather a note from someone I know than a compliment. People start to compliment me. I'm like, no. That's great. And you don't have to be friendly. Give me notes. I need to learn from notes.
Yeah, that's true.
So that helps a lot with directing those shows.
Yeah, if there's someone you trust who gives you some constructive feedback, sometimes it's better than someone saying, oh, you were fantastic, even though maybe you weren't that night.
Oh, thank you. I know. My biggest thing, and I will say this. The number one group of people that I ask for feedback about my show is kids.
Oh, yeah.
Because kids are brutally honest and will tell you everything. And they're the best. They're absolutely the best. You ask an 8-year-old or a 10-year-old what they think of something, and they will tell you.
Oh, yeah.
They will absolutely tell you.
Yeah. One of the things I've got from doing a few too many birthday party shows is the kids are so noisy. I'm starting to get tinnitus in my ears. So I wear earplugs.
Oh.
I wear earplugs. This is a thing, you know, after doing it for 20, 30 years, you start to get a little loud.
Yeah, yeah.
So I wear earplugs in my ears when I do the birthday parties. And
the
kids always, always, they're really hidden, but the kids always spot them. And always halfway through the show, there'll be one kid going, what's that in your ear? Why have you got something stuck in your ear?
Yeah, it's like a production item. You're like, ooh, ha ha! Oh, there's another one, ha ha!
I try
to make
it.
They're like sponge balls with your earplugs.
I try to make it like, do you want the loud show or the quiet show? And they want, the loud show. Okay, I better put these earplugs in so that now I make it so they actually know there's earplugs.
Yeah. It's like, this is the loud show, kids.
So you are actually basically, you're saying you're actually, from your experience with people like Joni Spina, who we might talk about later, and Connie, you have enough experience to know certain things about movement and staging, and you also do ask everybody you can for feedback. Does that mean you are actually directing your own show? You are in charge?
You know, in a way, yes. The place where I'm doing the show is called Sweet Shiny Atoms Theater.
Yeah.
And it's a little vaudeville theater here in Gatlinburg, because in the United States, no one actually knows what Sweet Shiny Atoms means, so they thought it would be funny to open that here. So it's Sweet Shiny Atoms, and it's been here for 42 years.
Yeah.
And my best friend runs the theater, Chris McPherson, and I used to work there as a comedic actress.
Yes.
So we did a lot of different bits together and wrote a lot of routines together, and I really tried to bring some magic in, whereas he brought comedy into what I was doing and a lot of physical comedy, which is something I didn't have a lot of experience with. So with him owning the theater, he's also in the show a little bit, because I think it's always fun to have another character that you can play off of. And I would say I'm directing the show about three quarters of the way, and then Chris also directs part of it too. He keeps me on track. His dad used to direct the shows, God bless him, and he said he would look at a show that someone put together and take out the improvements, is what he called it. And that was removing all the things that weren't necessary. So Chris looks at what I do and he takes out the improvements.
And just to pick on something, this sounds fantastic. This guy's family owns the theatre. So financially, you're not at a huge risk. You're not having to self-finance this yourself.
This is what's great, is we basically two-walled this, which I've always been terrified of any deal that was like a two-wall deal, because I'd heard horror stories, but I realized you just have to find somebody that you trust.
Yeah.
You know, it's not something you can go into, you know, without knowing the people and know their background, and I've known these people for about 8 years, I've performed in their theater, and I realized they have 8 o'clock shows every night here except Sundays in Gatlinburg. But it's a family-run theater, and they're in the box office from 10 a.m. on.
Mm.
So the lights are on, there's people there, they're selling tickets, they're paying the electricity bill, and there's so many families that come into this area because of the demographic. And I thought to myself, what would a matinee show be like here?
Oh.
Because all the power's already on,
yeah.
There's already someone in the box office. I mean, we keep the theater lights on because it's one of those places where it feels magical when you walk in.
Mm-hmm.
And we always say if we can get people to step in the theater, they'll buy a ticket to the show. It's just magical.
Yeah.
So I thought to myself, this would be great to have this. And people kept saying, oh, a matinee show in this town won't work. People want night shows. And then there's a couple of very wise magicians and I believe it was Keith West that was one of them. He said, you know, everybody told Matt King that a 1 p.m. show wouldn't work.
Right.
And look at what he's doing in Vegas.
Yeah.
I was like, that's a good point. And I know it usually takes in this area about 3 years for a show to catch on. Because at first, you know, the first season's usually slow, and the second year you get people to come back, and the third year you become sort of a staple. You know, and people start really attending the show, and you make deals with the coupon books and the websites that are out here, and everybody pushes each other a little bit more. But you know, to go in and rent a theater and do what I'm doing from scratch would be crazy. But the opportunity to be in a theater that's open at that time of day, that, you know, is already paying to have the lights on, and then two-wall it and try to bring families in
was ideal. Quickly. I hate it when I don't know a term. What does two-wall mean?
Two-wall, see, if you four-wall a theater, that's basically you're in charge of everything.
Right.
You're renting the space, you're paying the advertising, you're in charge of everything, so you put everything into it. Whereas the two-wall is sort of like I'm responsible for part of it and they're responsible for part
you're
of it. We sort of split it 50-50. So if people come in, you know, the ticket sales are going to get split 50-50.
Right. And
so it's a really, I like it. It's a good deal.
And I work in Hong Kong, where, unfortunately, the expatriate English-speaking community is pretty small. So sometimes a friend of mine will put on a show at a place called the Fringe Club, which is a small theatre, but they'll only be able to do a run for about maybe just one night or a few days, and then most of their potential audience will have seen the show, and that's it, you've done it. But you've got enough audience to come in regularly, year after year. Is it a tourist town, is it?
It's a major tourist town.
Right.
I'll be perfectly honest, though. Even living in the United States, I lived up in New Jersey, is where I was born and raised, yeah. And I had never heard of Gatlinburg, Tennessee, ever. I didn't even know it existed. And I ended up here by chance with a friend on vacation, and we're driving down the parkway, and all of a sudden it turns into, like, family-friendly Las Vegas, but there's also churches everywhere. So just picture Vegas with churches, and you get pigeonholes in Gatlinburg.
Wow.
But there's, I mean, you drive down the parkway, the first thing you see, there's a huge upside-down building called Wonderworks that's an interactive kids' science museum.
Mm-hmm.
There's this huge dinner show called the Hatfield-McCoy's Dinner Feud. It's like a southern-themed dinner show with everything from a pool inside to, I mean, they literally advertise diving hillbillies. And it's like a multi-million dollar production show. And then next to that, you have almost a life-size replica of the Titanic. That's a walk-through museum.
My goodness.
Like, it is a huge destination. I think there's something like 124 different attractions.
Okay.
In the area. And we've got, like, Ripley's Believe It or Not out here,
wow.
But it's not just their museum. They have an aquarium. They have a mirror maze. They have a Guinness World Records museum. It's a lot of
That's
stuff.
I've got it. You've got the perfect location
there. I would say it's one
there.
Of the top tourist destinations. Yeah.
Yeah. Because I was thinking, if you've got a matinee show in a town, then people will be working. How are they going to come and see your matinee? But then if it's accessible to tourists, then you've got people all day long. Perfect.
Yeah, and we're on a side of town. It's we're a Pigeon Forge. It sort of develops in different areas at different times. And the side of town that Sweet Fanny Adams has been on has sort of became a deader part of town.
Mm.
But recently, Jimmy Buffett's Margaritaville moved in behind us, and then Blake Shelton, a country singer, just bought a place next door. So it's becoming kind of hopping. I'm really excited. I think we're going to have walk-by traffic, and I think we're going to have a lot of families that are out walking around. And, you know, we had a horrible wildfire about 2 years ago that wiped out most of the area where we all lived. It didn't really touch the parkway where the attractions are, but we lost, like, 2,800 buildings, including the guy who owns the theater, Chris McPherson. Like, he lost his house. I lost a bunch of illusions. It was a crazy wildfire, and it was in the press, and unfortunately, the way the press portrayed it, it sounded like Gatlinburg was gone. And we're like, no, we're still here. Come see us.
Oh,
so last year was kind of hard because it was literally a year of campaigning that, hey, we're open, the shows are going, you know, everything's here. It's like, we're all sort of still trying to figure out what to do, but we can do shows for you, so come on down, you know?
Wow.
And I think people are realizing it now, so I think this is going to be a really good year here.
Well, this is fantastic. And you're opening this Saturday?
It's April 28th.
Wow.
So not this Saturday, but next Saturday. I'm excited.
That's amazing. It's really, really good news. That's so cool.
Thank you. And I want to go out to Hong Kong. Now I'm excited
sometime.
To go out there. I want to see you.
Hong Kong's cool. Yeah, you should come here one time. It's very, very cool.
Yes. Yes. That would be awesome. It's on my dream list.
Yeah,
I've never been.
Stay in touch and we'll work it out sometime. Maybe there'll be a show here
fabulous.
That you can come and do.
Oh, fabulous.
All right. So that's where you are right now. And let's go way back in time. Before you were even born... While you were in your mum's stomach, were you were you already in a show being sawed in half?
I actually was. That is so true. My mom was a magician's assistant, and she worked with a guy by the name of John Bundy, a fabulous illusionist. And she was getting sawed in half while she was up to like 6-7 months pregnant with me.
Wow.
So yes, technically speaking, I was on stage before I was born.
That's
in
brilliant.
An illusion.
And your father is not a magician, but he sometimes helped design magic tricks and things. He was interested in
yes,
that.
He's very, very clever. His regular job, his normal job in the normal person world is doing heating and air conditioning, and he designs ductwork and stuff, but he works on his own. So with all this heavy equipment, he's extremely good at using leverage thinking outside the box.
So
part
useful.
Of his daily routine is just that, to think outside the box.
Yeah.
So when I come to him and I say, hey, Dad, I've got this idea where I want this to happen, but this thing has to happen, and it sounds impossible, I don't necessarily know how to do it, but I think it would be really cool.
Oh,
and then
exactly.
He takes out a piece of paper and goes, oh, yeah, well, if you just do this, this, and this, it'll work. I'm like, oh, okay.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. I once had a girlfriend, and she was awful. She was a real psycho. But her father was a construction, had his own construction business, and it was brilliant.
Yeah.
He billed me anything I liked for my shows. It was so good.
Yes! And, well, and it's funny, too, because it's like they put no effort into it. It's like their brains just wired that way.
Freak out for 3 days trying to work out how to put a nail in a piece of wood, and he'd be like, it's all done.
Yeah. Exactly. It's like in 2 seconds he's completely solved your problem, and you're like, what? This took me 3 days.
Your aunt and uncle are magicians as well, is that right?
Yeah, they're technically my godparents, but I call them Uncle Al and Aunt Sue. And my mom ended up working for another magician named Al Belmont.
Yes.
He became my godfather.
Ah.
And I ended up going with them on the road when I was really little. So I grew up inside the illusions, outside the illusions, sitting on the cases backstage, in the truck, like literally going from place to place and surrounded by bunnies and birds and big white dogs and all sorts of animals for the show. There was a pony at one point, and it was just sort of normal. Like, that was the normal way of life, was going from show to show to show.
Wow, that is extraordinary. I mean, most people...
Yeah!
Because the performing world is such a small population, most people, like me... My parents and all my family were teachers, so becoming a performer was just something I hadn't even thought of while I was a kid, but
you
grew up in it.
Well, it's weird, though, too, because I guess, you know, it kind of helps coming from a family with performers in it, but at the same time, it sort of worked against me, because I love my family dearly, but when I said I wanted to be a magician full-time, they thought I was insane.
Ah, yeah.
Oh, yeah. In my mom's world, it was, I'm a magician's assistant. It's my part-time job. It's sort of what I do for fun. I do it. It's cool, but it's sort of for fun.
Yeah.
And when I said, so I want to run away with the circus for a year, and then I want to come back and be a magician full-time, and that's what I plan on doing with my life. They were not...
Cool,
I mean,
yeah.
It's not that they weren't thrilled. They were just sort of questioning my my choices.
Yeah. And also, I guess they'd know, because I know now that I'm in my... I'm almost 50 now. And you kind of realize that this won't... I won't necessarily be able to perform forever. That I've noticed in the 20, 30 years I've been doing this, there's been ups and downs when I've been in fashion, and there's been times when I haven't been so much in fashion. And there may be a time when work dries up. I know there are a few people who are the generation before me who've hardly got any work. So I guess having an older person, they might also know the pitfalls of embarking on something that seems so good when you're 20 but might be harder to do when you're 50 or 55 or 60.
That's true.
Yeah.
And that's why also, too, I've gotten advice, and actually I'll say this out loud, because if anybody's ever performing and wants an idea, this is something that's been repeated to me by numerous people, to find a way to make money in the entertainment industry without having to be on stage.
Yes.
And it could be anything.
Yeah.
It could be inventing a prop or doing workshops or anything like that, but just a way to make the money without having to be on stage. Because God forbid, you know, there's an accident that happens
exactly.
And you're off stage. You know, 6-7 months, you need to have something to do that's going to bring something in, you know? So
yes.
I guess it's almost like having a backup plan, but still linked to entertainment?
Yes.
Yeah.
Not even that. I have a friend, a magician who works on cruise ships in Asia called J.C. Sun, and he talks about...
Oh, yes!
He talks about a pyramid triangle where you've got three sources of income. You're performing... You've got your performing, your entertainment-related sales, like books or DVDs or workshops. But you also might have another source of income, maybe from rental or even through marriage.
Very true.
Yeah, so you've got a backup. You do need backups. You definitely do.
Oh, yeah, or like real estate. I figure, you know, I don't know that
yes,
my plans
yes.
are to be in Gatlinburg really long term. I don't know if this is a place for my show to grow and develop or if I want to be here for a long time. But if I did decide that I wanted to be here, I would look into buying some small cabins and renting those out as income.
It's amazing you say that. I might even get interrupted during this interview by an estate agent. And I'm signing a...
Oh, really?
Because I bought a second apartment, which I'm renting out. So, yeah, eventually have extra income from that.
Well, it's great, though. I've heard so much about that like, real estate is a great way to have extra income. In fact, Niels Dunker, the juggler, today I was talking to him, and he said that was advice that he just got to look into some real estate.
I think it's a really good idea. And I have to thank my wife for this, because my family knows nothing at all about real estate. But my wife's family know a lot about it, and they basically live off the rental income, a lot of my wife's family.
Oh, wow.
So I've got help from my wife. Yeah, you can. If you earned a fair bit of money in your 20s and you can buy a property, I think it's a very good idea, because it seems to be fairly safe from any downsides. Even when the economy goes rubbish, normally your property is the last thing to lose value. Yeah.
Well, in an area like Gatlinburg, too, you know, those tiny homes have become such a hit, and people are obsessed with them. And with things like Airbnb, I mean, you could have some land, get a couple of, like, the tiny homes, go on Airbnb and be renting those out.
Exactly.
You know, and you could have some serious income coming in with relatively low maintenance.
Hmm. Yes. All right, let's get back though. Rather than talking about the end of our careers, let's go back to you being a kid. So you have some time traveling around, being part of this your magic family,
and again, it was sort of a normal thing to be a part of the show, but I wasn't quite in the mindset where I decided I wanted to be a magician yet.
Yeah,
and that came, we performed at Abbott's Magic Get Together in Colon, Michigan, the magic capital of the world. And I think it was 2002, I got my first magic trick that was a dancing cane. Oh, and I worked my butt off on that thing. I loved it so much, and I loved that it wasn't easy when I got it, that it was something I really had to work on. So I took it everywhere with me.
So you're about 12, 13, 11 years old?
Yeah, I think 12 or 13 years old, yep. And then that same year, because my parents could tell I was really into it, they got me a Lance Burton magic set, because I was such a big Lance Burton fan. I still am, with his TV specials, and I wanted to see his Las Vegas show so badly. And they got me the Lance Burton magic set, and I popped in the VHS tape, and I was doing all the tricks. I was so excited. And a couple years later, maybe 2 years later, my parents got divorced. And it was one of those things where it was a rocky time.
Yeah.
And I feel like when you go through rocky times, you find something to cling to.
Yeah.
And now sometimes that can be bad, and sometimes that can be good. I'm really, really lucky that in my rocky time, I was able to cling to magic.
Yeah.
And that's what ultimately cemented that for me. Wow. I remember that year, I was probably 15, and I saw an ad in Magic Magazine for Lance Burton's Teen Weekend at the World Magic Seminar.
Yes, I've seen that on the internet.
Yeah.
When you're about 15, 16, you go to Lance Burton's Teen Weekend at the Magic World and Seminar. So is this quite a big turning point for you?
That was the huge turning point.
Yeah.
And I remember, too, this is horrible, and I'll admit this out loud, though, but I told my mom about it, and she's like, oh, you're not going to that. You're not going to that. She goes, your father's not going to take you to that. And I brought the ad home to my dad, and all I had to say was, well, Mom said that you won't take me. And he goes, pack your bags. We're going to Vegas,
fantastic.
Kiddo. I was like, I didn't mean to, like, to make it happen that way. But we went out, and I competed in the competition. And at the time, I had no idea what I was getting into or how to put together a routine. I did a horrible routine with this delight dance that didn't make sense, and I did a levitation and a metamorphosis. And I mean, it was fine for my age, but I learned quickly that was not the way to put together a routine and on a large scale with Joni Spina sitting in the front row and Siegfried and Jeff McBride and Lance Burton and Eugene Berger. And, oh boy, that was a, I learned some lessons, some big time lessons, but I had to go. That was the turning point right there. And I went back every year for a couple of years and it changed my life.
When you said you did a D-Light dance, is that D-Light thumb tips?
Yes, it was the D-Light thumb tips. Wow. And are you ready for this? I did a dance with my partner and we used D-Lights and we did a dance to Britney Spears Toxic. Oh, it was awful. It was so bad. But, oh man, yeah, I can't believe I'm actually even admitting that out loud, because someone, now I've got red hair and then I was blonde, and someone's going to go, oh, that was her? Oh! But hey, you got to start somewhere, right?
Yeah. Well, that's, yeah, go for it. I mean, when you're a teenager and you're just starting out, you just take whatever you can and go for it, yeah.
Exactly, and that's what I had.
Yeah.
I had D-Lights, and darn it, I was going to do a dance with them. And I'm not a dancer at all. I've never taken a dance class in my life. So it was quite interesting.
My next question here, it says, as a teenager, you were performing strolling magic in the casinos in Atlantic City. Is that true? Is that what happened next?
Yes, I did. I had a couple gigs at casinos. I had some friends that hooked me up with those. And it was really cool. Every once in a while, they do these special events at some of the casinos where they'll bring in, like, a circus act, or they'll do a themed week. And I got brought in for, it was these family days in Atlantic City, and I would do some strolling magic in the lobbies.
Yeah.
It's, like, right where you'd walk outside the casino lobby onto the boardwalk itself. And it was really fun because I'd never done strolling magic before. So it was neat to get to do the same tricks over and over and over again and see different people's reactions.
Oh, you'd never done strolling magic. You'd been brought up on stage shows, hadn't you?
Yeah. Ah. So that was my first time really doing that. I kind of went in reverse because I started with stage magic.
Yeah.
And then I went to the strolling magic, and then I did some restaurants, and then I did birthday parties.
Yeah, you've got in reverse.
So it was literally like working in reverse with stuff. And then I realized that, you know, stage magic is great, but I really liked the intimate magic. And I loved, you know, the first kids party I did, you know, that I could build such a relationship with them. I love that. And then I realized I could start doing some of the princess characters, and I did Jessie the cowgirl from Toy Story.
Yeah.
And that was a blast, because now I didn't just get to do my magic, I got to do it as a character.
Yeah.
And that was a big learning experience, which I never would have done had I not done those parties.
Yeah. Well, you've got a backwards career. I've got a similar backwards career. When I started,
really?
Yeah, when I started off with big corporate shows.
Okay.
It was just in fashion. And then I went to shopping centres and festivals, and
yeah.
Now my retirement plan is birthday parties.
There you go, man. Seriously.
Yeah, there's no real.
Sometimes it's like there's something about doing the birthday parties too, and I hate when some magicians be like, "Oh, birthday parties," and I'm like, "Dude, you show up at someone's house." You make everybody smile for 45 minutes, and you get a paycheck for doing what you love and sharing what you love.
You
can't do much better than that.
You shouldn't spread the word, actually. I think you should keep it a secret. Birthday parties are great.
Yeah, maybe that's true.
I really like them, because there's very, very little stress, and
yeah.
And there's a new audience born every year, so it just goes on and on and on. When I did stage shows, I was either in fashion or I was out of fashion. And every year I had to come up with a whole new 30-minute act if it was the same clients, and it was really, really hard. It was unsustainable, really.
And it gets darn expensive too, because when you know, with some of the different effects and you know, making sure like you get the licensed stuff and everything, it's expensive to put together new stage acts.
Yeah. The only thing I will say is with the kids' birthday parties, sometimes I do miss the fact that I don't have any barrier between me and the audience, because the kids will just come.
Oh, that's true.
The kids just become too wild sometimes and invade my stage space, but that's life.
Yeah. It's like you try to put the tape line on the floor, and that line goes away so quickly.
Yeah, they're like this tie. They just somehow they get closer and closer to me as the show goes on.
Yeah, it's like in those scary movies where the lights go out for a second and someone's like down a hallway. And you go out again and it's like you're right there. And you're
exactly.
Like, ah!
So you did close-up magic for the first time, really, at these casinos in Atlantic City. You get
yes.
Atlantic City. That's close to where you grew up. That's the same sort of.
Yeah,
area.
I lived in New Jersey.
Yes.
I lived sort of halfway between Philadelphia and Atlantic City.
Right.
So I was really in a perfect
Good.
Location to get to just about anywhere I needed to go. And even New York City was only about 2 hours north. So it was a great location.
Yeah. And you had it was. You said friends helped you, introduced you to that work in the casinos, the few casinos.
Yeah, it was perfect. You know, and it would be a friend would go, hey, you know, I know you do the stage stuff, you know, but I'm going to be gone this weekend. Is there any way you could cover this?
Right.
And I was like, yeah, sure. I'm like, but, you know, with the close-up magic, they're like, hey, listen, just take some of your stage stuff that fits in your pocket and do your stage stuff.
Yeah.
And then it'll slowly transition. You'll get more comfortable, work in a couple smaller effects. And that's where, you know, one of my favorite tricks I do is sympathetic matchboxes.
Oh.
And it's, are you familiar with that trick?
It's in where matchboxes seem to rise by themselves, rise and fall.
Yes.
The box, the drawers.
Yes, I love that trick.
Right.
Oh, I think it's so magical, and I love that it's not a card or a coin effect.
Yeah.
It's something completely different.
Sorry, I didn't describe it very well.
And that was where I started performing that.
I didn't describe it very well, so maybe you can describe it for people who are only listening and haven't seen it.
So it's basically, it's two empty matchboxes,
yeah.
And you remove the drawers and hand them to a volunteer. You show the boxes, you put them end to end, you place one drawer back inside, and as you place the other drawer inside, it moves the other drawer.
That's right, yeah.
And then, just when they think, oh, maybe it's an air pocket or something, you completely disconnect the two and put one on top of the other, and you close one drawer and the other one opens.
Fantastic.
But then you even space them out apart from each other where they're a finger length away, and you can have the volunteer slowly but firmly press down on one drawer and the other drawer will rise.
Wow.
And it's a really great effect. Again, it's one of the older effects, but it's beautiful. I love it, and it's so magical.
Great. And also, for close-up magic, I think one of the biggest... One of the hardest things initially is how to approach a group, a potential audience, because some people don't think they want to see magic.
Yes.
Of course they do, really. But how did you go, did you have any techniques for approaching groups, or was it very, very easy?
You know, a lot of times I would try to put myself in the mindset, because I was not very popular in school. I was the complete nerd.
Ooh.
So I would pretend with these groups that I would walk in and I was the popular kid at school and I was totally cool and that everyone wanted to talk to me. And I would put myself in that mindset and I would look around the room and make eye contact with someone. And if they made eye contact back, I'd realize it was approachable. I'd be like, you know, hi, my name's Jessica Jane. Are you guys having fun tonight? You know, I'm the hired entertainment for tonight.
Yeah.
You know, would you guys perhaps be interested in seeing a small miracle before your very eyes? And then I'm not saying I'm a magician yet.
Yes.
So they're like, a small miracle? Like, what is she going to do?
Yeah.
And start with, and I know everybody busts on it. They're like, oh, this trick, Professor's Nightmare. Professor's Nightmare was the first thing I'd do because I'd hand a rope to three different people, and now they can't leave.
Mm.
Now they've got my objects in their hands,
and
three of them are participating. And I would even have another guy say magic words or something. And it was a visual thing that got them involved.
Yeah.
And then I would do, like, the matchboxes or a card effect, and it worked pretty well. It really worked pretty well. And, again, I would also try to walk around the room and listen to little bits of their conversation, because a lot of people will be asking, oh, how's your daughter so-and-so?
Mm.
Or how's your mom? And because these people haven't seen each other outside work for a while. So I would also try to, in a semi-cold reading way, pick up on tidbits from groups or learn people's names if they didn't have name tags.
Oh, yeah.
And use that as an in.
Wow.
And that was fun. I enjoyed that. Because it's sort of like a Sherlock Holmes style
that's brilliant.
Of it.
Yeah. Now, I have to admit that I'm not a magician. Even though there's some magic tricks that I've been doing on stage for 25 years, I'm not a magician. I began this a bit like Niels Dunker through juggling.
Okay.
And juggling and recycling. But Professor's Nightmare is one of the tricks that I know. What was your routine? Did you have any special bits that you did in that trick?
Oh gosh, I think it was pretty to the point. Yeah. I would hand out the various ropes, the short piece of rope, the medium piece of rope, and the long piece of rope, have them examine them, and hand them back to me, bring them up and make them equal with themselves, and talk about how magic is simply an illusion, which it may look like as I pull on the ropes that they're all the same length, but that's not the case. See, the three of you see three equal pieces of rope. I see a short piece of rope, a long piece of rope, and a medium piece of rope. What do you see?
Yeah.
And they tell me they're three equal pieces of rope, and I go, not quite, and snap my fingers and undo them and hand them back to them.
Lovely.
So it'd just be like something about the illusion or the wonder. I'd go my Doug Henning style. It's the wonder of magic.
Also, I think just giving them the ropes straight off, that's a great way to do to start the close-up magic. Give them the rope, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
Street performing, too. I love that for street performing because now I've just guaranteed I have three people that can't walk away because they have my props. So I've just built at least three people, and I'll try to find other things to give people because I know, you know, there's like a 99% chance they're not going to walk away with my stuff.
Yes, yes, you've got them. They're captive.
Yeah.
<your props.
laughs> Yeah, and then I would usually, like, on the street, I do fire eating too after that. You know, to try to build more of a crowd. So now there's three people standing there, maybe two other people, something else.
Yeah.
Eat some fire, build a group. And I realized, too, that some of those, you know, strolling magic gigs are just street performing. It's street performing inside.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, except I already got paid. So I don't need to worry about trying to get tips off of them.
Okay. I'll just say two quick things about Professor's Nightmare. Let's see. I can use the longest rope to do some, to throw some knots. There's a few things where you can just hit the rope in a certain way and it falls down into a knot, so I do that.
Oh, yeah.
I do that.
Cool, cool.
And there's even a bit where you can get a kid and a mum, or a kid and a dad, to cross their arms. You put one end of the long rope in each hand, the dad opens his arms and no knot appears, and then you put the rope into the kid's crossed arms, and when he opens his arms, a knot appears. So I do that.
Oh, that's cool. That's very cool.
That's what I do with it as well. Yeah. But you mentioned...
Nice.
You mentioned street performing and fire eating. And I just like to do a quick note for non-American listeners, because maybe non-American listeners, like such as me, won't know what a sideshow is. So I'm just going to make an announcement.
Oh,
and
boy.
You can check.
That's the fun stuff. That's where life gets interesting here.
Yes. A sideshow is, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, it's kind of an extra secondary production that's kind of associated with a circus or a carnival or a fair. And often, the acts you'll see there could be freaky acts or stunts, or it might be an exhibit almost like a museum of oddities. And often it's a revolving show, a show that never ends, like a 10-in-1. It just keeps going.
A grind show, because it grinds on from the minute the Ferris wheel turns on to the minute the Ferris wheel turns off.
So an audience member would go in at any point. And after about maybe an hour or maybe after 45 minutes, they would have seen each of the 10 or so acts. But they can go in and come out at any time and to see the whole show. It just goes on and on and on. So once you've done your act, someone else comes on. Am I right? Is that right?
Oh, yeah. That's exactly right. And
okay.
There's been a lot of stuff in the American media over the last probably 5 to 10 years that has sort of brought sideshow back into its own light.
Right.
So, you know, usually with it being the secondary show you'd see after you leave the circus, you know, say you're leaving the circus and you go to the 10-in-1, you know, back behind the tent, and that's where you're going to see the fire eaters and the glass walkers and, you know, the various, you know, human you know, abnormality type acts. You know, the guy who has his hands attached to his shoulders, but he does a target whip act. And, you know, the woman who's 26, you know, inches tall, yet, you know, she does this amazing dance on broken glass. It's neat, and it's taken on its own sort of, like, cult following here, so to speak. It's been in a lot of songs, a lot of TV shows, a lot of movies lately. And when I was 17, I decided I was performing my magic at the New Jersey State Fair. It's upper New Jersey, close to New York. And I saw one of the very last 10-in-1 sideshows that's still running in the United States. There aren't many of them left.
Because
they sort of had fallen out of fashion.
Wardhall's World of Wonders, is that right?
Yeah, Wardhall's World of Wonders Circus Sideshow. And it's a full tent with a full banner line. And the banners, they have huge colorful banners that sort of are artist renditions of what you're going to see inside.
Yes.
Some of them are very accurate. Some of them are sort of a
exaggeration,
an illusion, so to speak. For example, you'd see Serpentina, the snake woman. She has the head of a beautiful woman, but the body of a snake. And you walk in, and at one point, my head is through a hole in the back of a box with a snake body attached. That might be Serpentina. However, I am going to sit in a real electric chair, and I'm going to eat fire and eat a light bulb and, you know, It was interesting. I joined them and I did a full season with them, and we easily did 20 to 30 shows a day.
Wow. So you ran,
and they were like,
you literally ran away with the circus sideshow after graduating high school.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, 1 week after graduating high school and I was on the road with them. Because it fascinated me. Houdini is a huge, huge inspiration to me and has had a huge impact on my life. I've read every book you can imagine. I have things that belong to him, like personal books from his library. I have sheet music that he traveled with in his act. A lot of stuff, letters from him and his wife. And that was how he started out.
Wow.
You know, he did high wire walking. He did a contortion bit where he would pick up a pin with his teeth off the floor in a back bend. He did regurgitation and carny style sideshow stuff. And I think that's something that made Houdini so unique, is that he did do magic and he did do illusion, but he also combined, you know, endurance and strength tests and sideshow.
Oh, you're like the 21st century of Houdini, aren't you?
Oh, I wish that sounds so cool. I would love to do that. And that's definitely the goal, you know, with things. I try to think outside the box. I want to be like a P.T. Barnum, Harry Houdini, yet as graceful as Joni Spina, you know?
Yeah.
But it got me so interested because, you know, when you go in the tent, I went in the tent my first night and I learned to eat fire. And I remember thinking, okay, like, what's the trick?
Yeah.
Like, there's got to be a trick. And I remember the owner of the sideshow told me to tip my head back and stick out my tongue, and he took a lit torch and he touched it to my tongue. And I remember thinking, oh, my goodness gracious, I just had fire on my tongue.
Yeah, the trick is no trick. You're actually doing it. I know.
Yes, yes. The same with the light bulb. Like, we learned to eat light bulbs.
Wow.
Now, granted, I mean, we can't use the light bulbs now. They've changed them to the halogen ones, which are not good because those are poisonous. Those are bad. But the incandescent light bulbs, we learned to eat those, and we were eating light bulbs.
Gosh.
Like, no trick to it. We chewed and swallowed light bulbs.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and I sat on an electric chair. I had 140,000 volts of electricity run over my body. I lit light bulbs with my nose. I shot sparks from my fingertips. I lit a kerosene torch from my tongue. We even did a bit, it was very dangerous, I would never recommend this, but we did a bit where we put a glass bowl of water in my lap while I sat on the electric chair, and they would bring the torch down to the top of the water. And because of the electric current, you could see the blue arc of the electricity go from the bowl to the torch and light it on fire.
Oh,
so it was lighting fire off water.
My goodness.
Again, very dangerous, but it looked incredible.
So this is amazing. You've learned magic from young, you've been to you've been doing magic, and then you join the circus sideshow and you learn basically crazy stunts, fire eating, from straitjackets.
Well, and at the same time, it's like you learn these crazy stunts, but you also meet these incredible people. And I know, like in the sideshow, they'll call them the so-called freaks because you have the working acts, which are the people that do the fire eating, the glass walking, and things like that. And then you have the quote-unquote oddities, or again, what they would call the freaks. And these people are incredible people.
Yes.
And a lot of them join up to show that, you know, here I have this, you know, thing that makes me different. Like, again, my friend John, his hands are attached at the shoulders, right? He does target whip act, and he's fabulous. Absolutely fabulous. Like, you meet these incredible people with these abnormalities, and yet they can do things that no person I know can do. So you have people come in the show, and some people will be like, oh, I don't know about this. And then they realize that it's not about putting people on display. It's about these people coming out on stage and showing, hey.
They're not being exploited.
I can do this.
Yeah, they're not being exploited. I think that was the point, because these things fell out of fashion because it seemed to be politically incorrect. But actually, the people, the performers in those shows, that's their job. And if you banned it, you're actually, it's not good for them. They're losing their work. That's what they do.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. It's funny, though, because some of the performers' jobs have almost been taken by the normal public. I remember when I first started the show, the guy said, well, darling, it looks like we'll have to get rid of the tattooed woman. He goes, it turns out most of the people coming in the tent have more tattoos than the woman herself. I was like, yeah, that's a good point. Like, certain things aren't taboo anymore, so they would have to remove them from the show.
Piercing and tattoos, yes, maybe not so unusual. Did you also learn...
It was fun.
Did you also learn other skills? Like, did you have to help set up the tent, hammer in stakes, get your hands dirty?
I did. I learned to lace a tent, how to lace the pieces together. I learned how to use a sledgehammer to drive tent stakes into the ground, which is much harder on fairgrounds where you're going through asphalt, concrete, and then clay, especially in the rain.
Wow.
And our stakes were not normal stakes. They were old car axles. And we'd have to put these car axles in the ground. There'd be three of us standing around hitting the tent stakes. And, you know, we'd have to, you know, raise the center poles. And we basically had our tent, it was a trailer mounted. So one side of the tent was attached to a trailer, and the other three sides were staked down and had sidewall, the typical tent material. And I'll tell you what, that show is still running now. It's fantastic. Run by a fabulous guy named Tommy Breen. It's still under Warthol and Chris Grice, but Tommy is excellent. The show is better than it's ever been, and if people are ever in America and are at a fair and they see the Circus Sideshow, it's so worth going to. They've got a full-on escape act now with a girl that's doing an upside-down straitjacket escape. They've got all the working acts. They have guest stars that come in and do incredible things. It's really cool to see. So if you get a chance, definitely see it. Or look it up on YouTube. They're fabulous.
Yes, definitely. I'll put the name in the notes to this podcast.
Yeah.
So you're 17 years old, though, and I guess, and you've joined this, you travel around America, just 17, so young, and and the fact that you're traveling around means that that's it, you've said goodbye to studying at school anymore.
Yeah, pretty much. I really did try. I was set on going to college, because I actually had, study political science in high school, and I decided I wanted to go to school for politics, and then I was like, oh, you know, but entertainment, and I signed up for a degree in entertainment management, and so few people were interested in the college I went to in Atlantic City that they dropped it.
Oh.
And then they sort of put us into a tourism and hospitality degree, and it was more of just the hotel business.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, this is great, but why am I paying so much money when I could be making this money going and doing what I love?
Yeah.
So it was almost like I went to the literal school of hard knocks. But what I learned at the circus sideshow and growing up around the carnival and doing those gigs, again, from going to performing arts centers, to casinos, you know, to state fairs, to circus sideshow, you're around every type of person and every type of venue, so you learn to work with every type of person. And I think that was really important.
Yeah,
and what a, and it was a young age to do it at. It's so weird. So weird looking back at it.
I mean, I have to stop and say that again. You're just 17. You did it for a year. was there any plan?
Yeah.
Was there any plan just to do it for 1 year? Were you thinking of like, this is just a year off and I'm going to travel around? Or
I honestly didn't know. Everything from there on out happened on its own.
Right.
It was very strange. I ended up meeting my first boyfriend on the sideshow, and he was one of the hosts of it, and we got together, and he had filmed a movie with a lovely man by the name of Alan St. George that lived in Savannah, Illinois, and it was very interesting. He has a very, very unique house. He's an artist and a sculptor, and he has a very unique house, but he's very interested in magic.
Yes.
And he was in a place where he wanted to work on a magic show.
Yeah.
But he's fascinated with the Romanovs, the last Tsar of Russia, and he looks exactly like the last Tsar of Russia.
Oh.
I mean, to the point where it's almost uncanny. So we get invited mid-tour for the sideshow to a dinner party with Alan, and he's talking about this show that he wants to put together. And then me and my magic brain, I'm like, oh, you could have this thing that does this, and then this could be themed to this, and here's the music for this. And he was so fascinated by my ideas. He's like, would you like to just come out, and would you guys like to work on the act?
Mm.
And I was like, you know what? Actually, yeah, that sounds incredible. So for about a year, we were out there and we worked on this themed magic show. And that in itself is a huge lesson and was a huge undertaking that we all learned from. Magic is one thing. Putting magic to a storyline play, a magical play, was a huge, huge undertaking.
So it's,
and I think we did a really good job for what for what we put together with it. You know, we ended up performing it a couple times, and we had a blast. But that was a big jump, too. So here we're going from eating fire and walking on broken glass to portraying the Romanovs in a magical play.
Yeah. For people who don't know who the Romanovs are, you've got to think of Rasputin. He was the guy.
Oh, yes.
He was the guy curing the son of
Alexei.
Blood disease.
He had the blood disease.
Yeah.
Yeah,
Rasputin was in the show.
Rasputin was in the show, and it was sort of a show about love conquers all, and it took place in a museum. The opening set was a museum. That had things that belonged to the Romanovs, and there was a janitor that was cleaning the museum, and at night the museum came to life. And Nicholas and Alexander Romanov came into the museum and sort of put on a magical party in this museum where all their things ended up. And we worked Rasputin into it, and it was really neat. It was something that Alan really, you know, he was very interested in the Romanovs, and he was very interested in magic, so he got to combine his favorite things together, you know?
So the plan is...
The
plan is, there was no plan. Sorry for me interrupting. It was just...
Oh, no, there was no plan.
The circus sideshow was performing opposite you in Atlantic City. You joined that. By chance, you get involved with Alan St. George putting on a play involving magic.
Yep.
And then
Alan St. George and I went on a trip to Pigeon Forge, Tennessee, that I'd never heard of in my entire life.
Go.
We went there for Thanksgiving to see a friend of his, and his name is Terry Evanswood, and he's been performing in this town for 22 years.
That's my next question. When did this happen?
This was in 2010.
Right. Yeah, that's right. 2010. My next question. How did Jessica Jane end up in Gatlinburg in Tennessee, where she's putting on a solo show in a theatre? Wow. Well, it's a bit of a cliffhanger ending, but it's a very long episode, so this is where I'm going to end today. But I'll put up the second half of the interview next week. All right, take care, guys. Bye-bye. Jessica Jane's Magic Comedy and Variety Show will be opening on the 28th of April 2018 at the Sweet Fanny Adams Theatre in Gatlinburg and running right through to the 29th of December 2018. Wow! We'll talk about that next week.